It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
This is the Fox News Rundown Extra. I'm Jessica Rosenthal. This week we spoke to the Democrat and Republican running in one of the hottest toss-up seats in these midterm elections. Democratic Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin represents the 8th District, but she's now running in the 7th. And after redistricting, this district would have gone for President Biden by just under a point. She and her Republican challenger, State Senator Tom Barrett, have been sparring over many of the issues the parties have been fighting over, including abortion and inflation, as well as the 2020 election, and the government's role in manufacturing incentives in Michigan. But they both insist they're interested in bipartisanship. This race has seen a ton of money thrown at it. Slotkin's campaign has outraised Barrett's, but millions of dollars in outside spending from PACs and super PACs highlights the high hopes both parties have for this seat. We often have to cut interviews down for time during the week, but thought you might like to hear these full interviews. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to the Weekday Rundown podcast if you haven't already. Now, up first is Democratic Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin on the Fox News Rundown Extra.
So I understand after redistricting, this new District 7 would have gone for the president by just under a point. What do you feel about that, that the tightness of this, like what's been your biggest challenge that you see in this relatively new district you're running in?
Yeah, well, remember that my current district that I represent, you know, before redistricting was actually tougher. It went for Donald Trump.
Right.
So I'm one of 5 Democrats who currently represent a district that went for Trump in 2020 again. But the district, you know, we got 3 new counties, about 35% of it is new. And it's a lot of rural communities, small towns, you know, folks who have an eye towards Washington, but are really focused at home, on their pocketbooks, on their kids, in a just a much more sort of small town Midwestern way.
Okay, I want to ask this: have you had any, given that it's you're talking to sort of new constituents, have you had any like uncomfortable or awkward conversations on the campaign trail? And I ask this because I read that Dan Kildee, the Democrat running in Michigan's 8th, was door knocking and he told them his name at one person's house. And they said, yeah, I know who you are, but I'm pro-life and I can't vote for you. And it just made me wonder, because of redistricting, people are encountering new voters that they haven't represented before. Have you had any interesting conversations on the campaign trail with anyone?
Well, again, I think it's all relative, right? Because I always represented a Trump voting district, so people felt very free to come up to me and, you know, say, even in my current district, and say, look, I don't agree with you on X, or I'm really concerned about Y, and you're not, you know, doing what I want you to be doing. People are pretty open about that. And certainly I've had town halls that have been sporty, where people have come and expressed their views. But that's our system, right? I mean, I never found it deeply uncomfortable, unless it, of course, you know, the times where it maybe got more threatening. But I think that as long as people are respectful, right, as long as they're there to say, look, I have concerns about what you're doing or about what you're saying, that to me is democracy, right? Is talking to your representative.
What concerns have you heard from? Have there been concerns that you've heard from people where they have said, you know, we don't like what you're doing, or we wish you would do X? And has one issue cropped up more than another?
Well, I think in Michigan right now, the 2 countervailing winds that are blowing the hardest are, of course, inflation, because it's very real. And every single family that I know is making different choices because of inflation. And that's, you know, that's not fun. And then the other one, because we have it on the ballot, is the issue of Roe v. Wade and choice. And, you know, people are going to be able to vote on that on Proposition 3 because we're a total ban state. So those are the 2 major things. Like, if you knock on the door, there's still always a slow simmer of people who deeply feel that healthcare and prescription drugs are too expensive. There's always people here who, you know, deeply care about just like money and politics and the sort of bad corruption of the system. But those two issues really top when we knock doors. That's one of those two issues is at the top.
This race is among the, or maybe the most expensive House race in the country. And that's saying something, because as this election, at least when it comes to ad spending, is projected to top even the election year of 2020. What do you think it is about this district and your race that's making it sort of ground zero for the, you know, the toss-up districts in these midterms?
Well, I think, look, I had a very expensive race in 2018 when I was the challenger. It's just a true Midwestern swing seat. I mean, people go back and forth. They still, thankfully, vote the person over the party. And so it makes it very competitive. And then to be a swing district and the toughest swing district in a swing state, you know, we always end up being like a bellwether for what's going to happen across the country. So we get a lot of interest because of that. And, you know, I think... To me, people want to know what's going on and they use it as an example. And I think that that's a positive thing. Now, the money coming in, I mean, the super PAC money alone is what's making this so expensive. And certainly as someone who's, you know, had a ton of Republican super PAC money come in that's sort of swamped us, it is, you know, it's never fun to watch the attack ads and it's kind of all over TV, but you know, you just got to trust that voters are smarter than kind of slapstick attack ads.
The president's talked about, you know, things like codifying Roe, releasing more oil from the reserves, pushing student loan reforms. Are these things helping Democrats like you? Where have you disagreed with the president? Do you disagree with the president on any of those things, or does the stuff that he's talking about lately help your case?
Well, I mean, the one that was very relevant a month and a half ago, because I represent five, you know, colleges and universities, and especially Michigan State University, so a very big state school, was his student loan relief plan, which frankly I disagreed with. And I, you know, I can feel happiness for the people who are going to benefit from it, but it was a Band-Aid on a gaping wound called college affordability. And it didn't get to any of the root causes. So if you're a freshman at Michigan State right now, you're not going to benefit from this plan. And to me, that one, you know, despite the fact that I have a lot of college students in my district, I just can't, on principle, agree with bad policy. And that's what I thought it was. So there are definitely areas where I disagree. And, you know, the to me, like, that's part of representing an independently minded district and being someone who, frankly, before 2018, 2017, was a completely apolitical CIA officer married to an Army officer. So, you know, you gotta just speak what you think is true, even though, you know, populism would tell you to do something different.
Republicans, when they're asked about inflation, you know, they say one of the biggest things they can do is just not spend money anymore, just stop the spending. Looking back at the spending you did go with, did you feel all of it was necessary, whether it was COVID relief, the infrastructure bill, chips and science, the so-called Inflation Reduction Act? Is all of that worth it? Do you tell your constituents, look, we had to spend that money, or that spending wasn't inflationary?
Yeah, I think that it depends on what program we're talking about, right? If you're here sitting in mid-Michigan and you know, we have a ton of auto plants, a bunch of auto workers and retirees, people who work at parts plants, and you start talking about chips and the CHIPS Act and incentivizing an American, you know, microchip industry, you'll get applause, right? No matter what side of the aisle they're on, because we have had our plants on again, off again, stopping and starting for 18 months because of a 14-cent microchip. So that program, I have found there to be really strong support for. Prescription drug, lowering the cost of prescription drugs, particularly allowing Medicare to negotiate drug prices. Those, I think, I feel strongly about. You know, when you vote on a bill, you know, and infrastructure as well, I should say. Infrastructure is the whole reason we're able to do things in Michigan, is because we passed a bill last November at the federal level. Now, no bill is perfect. And anyone who sells you a bill of goods and says, you know, I only vote for something if it's a perfect bill and otherwise I'm out, that's just not how legislation works. It is about negotiating, particularly with the other side, and not getting everything that you want. That's the nature of a deal, and anyone who's gone to work knows that. So do I support everything that's been in every bill? No. Would I have loved if there would have been programs that came off some of the bills about a year ago? Yes. But I have to make a decision on net on what's good for my district. And when it comes to things like prescription drugs, I hear about that like consistently for 4 years. Hmm. So how do I vote against lowering the cost of prescription drugs when people stop me in the grocery store crying because they can't afford their child's insulin? So you just have to make a decision and use your judgment and then be able to explain it to your voters.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.
To that point, if Democrats don't do well, and I know the projections, right, the Republicans will take the House. But if it's by a lot, what will be something you would say that maybe Democrats should have focused on more or less?
I mean, I had said this over and over, both publicly and privately, since last November. Every single White House press conference since, I think, last November should have started about the economy. That we should have been talking more seriously about the economy and the plan a year ago. And I'll be honest, there were people who on my side of the aisle who were like, look, it's temporary. And like, let's not talk about it. And that was a crap suggestion. And it just doesn't, I'm sorry. Sorry to use not so nice language, but that to me, I'm not saying that this administration or frankly, any future administration could just like fire a silver bullet and fix inflation with one blow. And that's the thing I would ask to my Republican colleagues is like, they're almost gleeful about inflation. When gas prices went up, you know, people like my opponent were celebrating. And it's like, look, we're going through something right now as a country, and we need leaders who say, look, this is how we chart our way out of this. And talk about what we're going to do to try to manage the pain.
Is charting the way out of it, though, Congresswoman, is part of it, you know, allowing more gas and oil production and setting the environment, sending the signal to gas and oil producers that while we tackle climate change, while we focus on, you know, incentives for electric cars, and we focus on that, we should also, part of the plan, be to at least in the short term produce more oil and gas.
My approach on energy is it should be all of the above, including oil and gas, including in our country, including nuclear, including things that people don't talk about every single day. You know, that's kind of like electric vehicles versus gas. But to me, I come from the Pentagon, right? That's my last job in the executive branch in 2017. And the way you do planning for resilience so that you're not like overly invested in one supply chain is you diversify. You have a ton of different ways to get that fuel. So I am absolutely open to additional, you know, permits, drilling, whatever it is, because I want a whole menu of energy coming and giving us that resilience as we use more and more. So I'm not against that. I just think it's not all about that. And anyone who says, well, if we just said tomorrow that we should start drilling, that we can snap our fingers and have more oil online, change the price of oil, is again selling a talking point. Mm-hmm. So I just want to be practical about it. And that to me is diversity, including oil and gas.
Last question. What are the biggest differences between you and Tom Barrett? I mean, obviously you're a Democrat, he's a Republican, and in this environment, you know, pretty stark pictures have been painted. But what do you want your constituents or potential constituents to think of when they think of those differences between you and your Republican opponent?
Yeah, I mean, there are many differences. We have totally different views on economics and like competing for that next generation of vehicles to be made in Michigan, of the next generation of manufacturing here. He doesn't want to throw $1 at that problem. I am absolutely willing to be Team USA over Team China, and we differ on that. We differ, obviously, on the issue of choice. Very clearly, he's for no exceptions, and I believe that Roe v. Wade is a decent standard. But I think at the end of the day, what is different about this opponent from previous campaigns and opponents that I've had is that in previous campaigns, I've run against someone who's been just really straight about their views. They haven't tried to hide. They've owned them. That doesn't mean I agree with them. Of course, we're competing. But I sort of respected that they put out there, this is my view. It's always been my view. I'm holding to this. And now I think what we see is someone who's actually got a more extreme record, who's been, you know, really sort of on the record with his votes and with his statements in a sort of right of his own party, votes against his own party during bipartisan deals, who's now trying to tap dance because his consultants say that it's a tough race and you want to win. And that to me is about character. And I think it would be, to me, the most important thing of this race is, look, people don't have to agree with me on everything. They'll never agree with me on everything. But do you want principled leaders? Do you want someone who listens and who will tell you straight what they're going to do? Or do you want someone who just is sort of at the whim of the next political talking point and yet will vote in a more extreme way? And I think that's the fundamental difference.
What is he tap dancing around?
Certainly around abortion. I mean, he has campaigned and fundraised off for his whole career on zero exceptions, nothing for women who are raped or who have been the victims of incest. He's been very, very staunchly. He's introduced legislation to increase criminal penalties on doctors and women. Like, he's really been a champion on that issue. But then when he's in a tough race, he'll just say, I'm pro-life, I'm pro-life. When they ask him specifically, what about, you know, women who have been raped? He's been told not to say any of those words. And he just won't own his position. And I think, particularly for women, they can see through that. And I just, again, if you have that strongly held view, which lots of people do, just own it, man.
Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We did talk to Slotkin's challenger, State Senator Tom Barrett, who, like many Republicans, is talking about inflation, crime, the border. But this district, as are others, has its own unique challenges. And we talked about some of those as well. Now, here's Republican congressional candidate Tom Barrett.
I'm going to start with this because we just interviewed Ms. Slotkin. And she says about your race, about differentiating herself from you. Her claim is that you have tap danced around certain issues, that you haven't been straight enough with voters in her mind. And I pressed her on to give an example, and she said, for example, abortion. Where are you on abortion, and would you like to take this opportunity to respond to that criticism?
Sure. And, you know, my opponent is in a desperate attempt to try and, throw criticism at me to deflect away from her failures in Congress that have, you know, led to record high inflation that families like mine are facing, energy costs that are through the roof. We're about to hit another cold winter in Michigan, and we're already seeing that home heating costs are just going to be astronomical this winter. But my opponent wants to make this entire campaign about abortion. I am pro-life. People in my district know that about me. I've been elected as a state legislator with a pro-life voting record. In Michigan, we have this disastrous Proposal 3 late-term radical abortion proposal on the ballot that my opponent supports. It would allow for taxpayer-funded late-term abortions with no parental consent whatsoever. So she's very extreme in this. Very few people hold the opinion of my opponent that we ought to have this no-holds-barred late-term abortion position in Michigan. There are very few countries in the world that allow abortions beyond 20 weeks of pregnancy. In fact, it's just the United States and six other countries. And if Michigan passes this proposal, it will nullify all of our state laws that have restrictions on late-term abortions. And Michigan would be in league with China and North Korea for some of the most extreme abortion laws in the country. So I can't be more clear about it. I'm opposed to Proposal 3. That's what my opponent supports. There's no lack of clarity there. She supports these late-term proposals. I frankly don't.
Tell us what you did in the Michigan State Senate that you're proud of, and also if you feel there's any, I guess, unfinished business that you might be leaving behind if you were to transition to Congress.
Yeah, I'm very proud of the record I have in the Michigan legislature. I've served for the last 8 years, two terms in the state house, and now in my initial term that I was elected to 4 years ago in the state Senate. I'm the only Iraq War veteran in the Michigan Senate. When I ran for office 8 years ago for the state house, I was elected as the only Iraq War veteran in the Michigan House of Representatives at the time. I won my race campaigning on veteran issues. Michigan at the time had the second highest veteran unemployment rate in the entire country. And I saw firsthand battle buddies of mine that I had served with that really struggled to find opportunities here in Michigan. And I decided to run for office to try and do something about that. Got elected. I've had a number of veteran legislation that I've sponsored that's been signed into law, some by Republican Governor Rick Snyder and others by our current Democrat Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Those are things, those bipartisan accomplishments for veterans are things I'm proud of, whether that's assisting veterans who have the invisible wounds that they come home with and now have service animals or service dogs that assist them in that reintegration effort, whether it's employment protections for veterans or child custody arrangements. We had a tragic case of a service member on a submarine who was being penalized because he couldn't appear in court over a child custody dispute. So we changed the law here in Michigan to say that a judge can't use that against a parent when they're dealing with child custody considerations, that they can't penalize someone simply for serving in the military as it relates to their child custody arrangement. And then most recently, we had a veteran here in Michigan who was permanently and totally disabled through his service in Afghanistan. His student loans were forgiven as a result of that. But then it was counted as taxable income against him by the state of Michigan. And the state of Michigan put a lien against his house and garnished his wages. We changed the law here in Michigan to make sure that if your loans are forgiven because of your, onset of disability from military service, that you're not going to lose your house as a result of that. Mm. So we've had some great accomplishments there. I've also worked in other areas of state law, on energy policy, on government transparency. I worked with my Democrat colleagues to unanimously pass legislation for whistleblower protection for state employees in Michigan who contact state lawmakers with concerns they have. Every Republican and every Democrat in both chambers of the legislature voted for that bill, but tragically it was vetoed by Governor Gretchen Whitmer. When we received the bill back after her veto, not a single Democrat would join us in overriding her legislative or her executive veto of that legislation. So I was disappointed to see that, the Democrats who had just voted for the bill a few days earlier wouldn't join us in overriding the governor's veto. But that would be one thing that I point to as unfinished business that we need to wrap up. And I have a number of other things that, I'm still working on as we wind down this term in the legislature. And, there will be more challenges that Michigan faces into next year when I'm no longer part of the Michigan legislature. But, God willing, I'll be serving in a different capacity in the United States Congress.
You've said one of the reasons you're running for Congress is to help put parents in control of their children's education. I understand the popularity of that argument, especially after the pandemic. And it certainly worked for somebody like Glenn Youngkin when he ran as Virginia governor. But as you know, education is a very local thing. And some conservatives have even said things like we need to abolish the education department. How do Republicans like you plan to give parents more control of what's going on in schools and classrooms from a federal position in D.C. when education decisions really seem to happen, at a local school board level, like at the county level?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in Michigan, we have local school boards, and those are being very hotly contested this year as parents are waking up to the reality that the curriculum and the challenges that their kids are facing in school now was, used to be something they took for granted that schools were moving in the right direction. And there are a great number of, teachers and administrators and school districts throughout our state and throughout our country. They're just doing great work to educate our kids. But unfortunately, there's been an effort to influence that curriculum and teach kids things that are counter to the values of their parents, whether that's, as it relates to gender policies for young children. My opponent hosted a book reading for kids age 4 to 8 about transgender, policies and transgender affirming positions in schools. I have children that age, and that's not something that I want my kids to be learning about in school. That is something that, you know, my wife and I certainly will approach that issue as they are age appropriate to understand that. And I think parents are, you know, really concerned about that overreach by schools. And at the federal level, you know, in our commitment to America that the Republican conference has rolled out, that all of us are running on those issues includes supporting a parent's bill of rights so that parents will be aware of what's in the curriculum for their kids, and that we're not going to have young men or boys participating in girls' sports. I think those are things that parents are just, you know, upset to find, and they're taking opportunities away from young girls and young women when you see this happen. And parents want to see a change. That's something we got to do. It really does start at the local level, but certainly the federal government provides grant funding and other resources to school districts. And we ought to take the lens that parents are in charge of their kids' education, not bureaucrats in Washington, D.C.
I know a lot of Republicans right now are talking about inflation, crime, the border. And so a lot of these local congressional races start to all kind of sound the same. But you actually have something going on in Michigan in your district that's pretty unique, and it has to do with, I would say, manufacturing. You have gone after Congresswoman Slotkin on corporate incentives, tax incentives, to get companies to produce in Michigan. I think I read that you called the backing of such incentives to GM for their battery cell plant in Lansing corporate welfare. I look at like Ohio and Intel and the CHIPS Act, and so I just want to ask you, what about corporate welfare? I mean, even some conservatives will tell you that, you know, while government should be limited and small, you can still use the power of incentives and tax related ones at that to push, you know, an agenda. Why is that one of your criticisms?
Yeah, well, it's not tax incentives. Tax incentives and having a competitive tax structure certainly is a conservative, you know, viewpoint that I hold, along with, you know, probably most or nearly all other conservatives. We have to have a competitive tax system. What they are actually attempting to do, and what my opponent has supported, is direct cash subsidies for private global corporations. And this money comes out of the back pocket of working families that are facing 40-year record high costs of living challenges, record high inflation, and fuel costs that have hit an all-time high. And families are struggling to pay the bills and just get by. And Alyssa Slotkin's answer to this is to take money from them that they pay in taxes. You know, I remind people, these aren't voluntary, these are mandatory. And if you don't pay your taxes, you'll go to jail. And they take that money that they extract from people's wallet, working families, and they give it to these private global corporations. And the result of this here in Michigan is the jobs that are being so-called created under this scheme are going to cost taxpayers over $166,000 for each and every one of those jobs under this plan. And the jobs are going to pay the workers only $46,000. And they only have to last 6 months for them to keep all of the money. And the jobs that are created through this General Motors venture are actually through a General Motors subsidiary. So they aren't even UAW jobs. And Ford, out of the same fund, received $101 million cash check as well to create 3,000 jobs. And 2 months later, they laid off 3,000 workers and kept the money. So these deals do not develop as they're promised. The jobs are only required to last 6 months. They cost taxpayers four times more than the workers are going to actually receive in wages. And the stacking up of issues of concern with it lead me to feel like, you know, the corporate entities that have the lobbying muscle and the ability to influence policy twist the arms of these legislators to get these high dollar corporate, you know, subsidies in place. These aren't tax code changes that benefit all taxpayers by being more competitive. They directly pick winners and losers, and they are done in a way that benefits those that, you know, play along with the legislators and the executive branch that vote for them. And on top of that, probably, you know, one of the worst elements of it is you had legislative leaders here in Michigan and our governor and her staff signing non-disclosure agreements in the midst of voting on this policy. So you had legislators signing non-disclosure agreements before voting on this. I flat out refused to sign any type of non-disclosure agreement because that's not an appropriate or ethical way to go about the task of legislating. So I have campaigned hard against corporate welfare, against picking winners and losers, and taking money from working families and giving it to some of the most profitable and highly competitive private global corporations, because that's not how government is supposed to work. And then the last thing I'll say about this is, as it relates to competition, when you look at the top 10 reasons why corporations choose to select a location to expand, incentives rank very low on that list. And things that rank far higher are infrastructure, energy costs, and talent. All things that we could be spending the people's tax money on to benefit everyone in this state. But instead, we take money out of our infrastructure. And Michigan ranks very low on infrastructure quality. We disinvest from that to give cash subsidies to global corporations. And Mary Barra, the CEO of GM, makes 461 times what your starting wage salary is for one of the assembly line workers at General Motors. When we're paying General Motors four times more than those workers are going to make in wages, in tax dollars, the rest of that money is going right into those corporate back pockets.
Would you have voted for the infrastructure bill?
The infrastructure bill, no. It was cluttered up with a whole bunch of other stuff. It had, you know, tax credits for millionaires. It had a lot of other, you know, spending that was not related to infrastructure. And, you know, when the federal government and Joe Biden tries to say that basically everything is infrastructure, it gets cluttered up with too much other things. If they want to do a clean bill that simply invests in American infrastructure, then that's a conversation we absolutely should have. And that's something that I would likely support. But the way they cluttered that up with so many other things, you know, did not make sense to do.
I know you're a combat veteran. You were in the Army for, I think, what, 2 decades? I want
22 years.
22. Thank you for your service. Your thoughts on this aspect of foreign policy. Tell me about Ukraine, because we see House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy questioning, you know, blank checks, as he called them, to help Ukraine. Mm-hmm. But Pennsylvania Representative Brian Fitzpatrick said, OK, blank checks shouldn't be a thing, but we shouldn't really necessarily stop or slow down military aid to Ukraine. Where are you on this?
Yeah, yeah. And I do have a background in the military. I joined the Army my senior year of high school and took the very first airplane ride of my life to basic training just after I graduated, and spent, wow, you know, the last 22 years of my life in the Army, deployed around the world to Iraq, Kuwait, Guantanamo Bay, and South Korea. Got selected to fly some really amazing helicopters, some of the most advanced helicopters in the world, and just retired earlier this year with a little over 1,000 hours as a helicopter pilot, and could never have done that anywhere other than America. And it's been the greatest adventure of my life, and one that I reflect on quite a bit. And I learned in my time in the Army that we can't be everybody's policeman in the world. You know, we can't be everywhere and we can't fight every war. And what we've seen with the Ukrainians is, when we told them we were not going to be there with boots on the ground, they rose to the occasion to defend their country. They knew that they needed to dig deep and defend their country, and they've done that. And I'm certainly someone who supports our efforts to help them in that cause. I don't support sending boots on the ground into foreign countries without very strong, you know, awareness of what we're doing, what winning looks like, and what our exit strategy will be. Because unfortunately, we've seen over the last 2 decades that it's very easy to get into wars and very hard to get out of them. And I don't want to see us drawn into another 2-decade-long conflict. I think we can help other countries without sending American troops. You know, any type of appropriation with the people's dollars ought to be done in a way that is responsible. And I think that, you know, a level of responsibility and oversight is certainly important. But that doesn't mean we're not going to help other countries, certainly countries that find themselves in a position like Ukraine, and the Ukrainians that are really bravely fighting and in many instances losing their lives in that fight. You know, I give them all the credit, and, you know, our prayers are with them every day. You know, I think that as we continue to invest in that, they are continuing to succeed. I don't know where the war is going to turn, and I don't want to prejudge what might, you know, be a geopolitical conflict that escalates from there. But I think we've shown that when we are not sending messages or signals that we're going to be there with boots on the ground, those countries will rise to the occasion and defend themselves.
Finally, does all of this feel a little overwhelming? You are in one of the hottest races in the country, among the most expensive races, and maybe the most expensive midterm year ever. What's the pressure level like?
Yeah, it is. You know, there is a lot of pressure. There's a lot to, think about. My opponent, you know, we're just a few weeks from this election, and she's on pace to spend $1 million a week attacking me over the final days of this campaign. Like I told you, you know, I'm just an army grunt that is, you know, a dad with four kids trying to do my best to put America back on the right track. There were a lot of reasons not to run for Congress. Family, you know, responsibilities, the challenge of campaigning, the challenge of governing. But there was one reason to do it, which was that America's on the wrong track. And I can't look at my kids and say, you know, America was on the wrong track and I didn't do anything to fix it when it mattered. So I, you know, I feel strongly about this. I don't pretend to be somebody I'm not. And I just want to do the right thing to try and get the country back on the right track. It's been our campaign theme this whole time. I'm a working class conservative. And, you know, I think that the voters of this district will see that. Despite the disparity of funding between myself and my opponent, I feel strongly that, you know, come election day, that we'll be, we'll win this seat. And our polling is neck and neck, despite the fact that my opponent has spent, you know, well in excess of $10 million at this point. The total spending in this district is close to $30 million. We're hanging in there neck and neck right now, and I'm confident that we're going to win this thing in just a few more days.
Michigan Congressional Republican candidate Tom Barrett in the 7th. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. People want to go to my website. It's tombarrettforcongress.com. Help us get over the hump at the, you know, at the end of this and fight back against that funding that's being spent against us.
Good luck, sir.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. Stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz Podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Pull up a chair and join me, Rachel Campos Duffy.
And me, former U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, as we share our perspective on the discussions happening at kitchen tables across America.
Download From the Kitchen Table, the Duffys, at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts.